90.1 Chico KZFR, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, foothills, and beyond. And up next is Ecotopia, and our topic tonight is the proposed Valley Edge development.
Slashed and torn.
Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valleys, the foothills, and beyond, and you are listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Trudy.
And I'm Stephen Trudy. Tonight, our topic is the proposed Valley's Edge development plan for the foothills east of Chico. We'll talk with two board members from the Butte Environmental Council about the potential environmental impact of this project.
Maggie Scarpe is a board member of the Butte Environmental Council and their advocacy committee chair. And Jared Geiser is an environmental activist working on issues of sustainability and climate change.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County. Year-round markets in Chico at the North Valley Plaza on Wednesday morning and at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico on Saturday morning. There's also a seasonal market in Paradise on Tuesday morning. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. And were made possible by the Friends of Butte Creek, presenting the 15th Annual Wild and Scenic Film Festival on November 20th at the Arc Pavilion on Park Avenue. It will also be virtually available from November 20th through Thanksgiving. Tickets for both the live and virtual events are available at buttecreek.org. Friends of Butte Creek, protecting and restoring the watershed for over 20 years.
And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not represent or reflect the opinions of the staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Maggie Scarpa and Jared Geiser. This is Ecotopia on KZFR.
Trees and starved to creatures. There's poison in the sea and in the air. But worst of all, we've learned to live without her. We've lost the very meaning of our lives, and now she's gonna die.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Our topic tonight is the proposed Valley's Edge development project in the foothills east of Chico. With us by phone are Maggie Scarpa and Jared Geiser. Maggie is a board member of the Butte Environmental Council, and she is their advocacy committee chair. She's a county land use planner, brings her planning experience and education to the table while advocating for smart land use decisions for and with the Butte County Butte Environmental Council. Jared is a Chico local who's been an advocate on issues of sustainability and climate change. He currently works as a conservation planner. Welcome to you both.
Hello, great to be on the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So we're going to talk about the Valley's Edge project, and I know you all are really well educated on it, but let's set the stage for our discussion of the proposal for this big project. There it is. First of all, can you describe the Valley's Edge project? Where is it, and what does the development consist of?
Sure, yeah. So basically, the Valley's Edge development is a super large housing development, approximately 1,500 acres, sprawling between Stilson Canyon Road and Skyway, or more or less between Little Chico Creek and Butte Creek, just filling in that whole hillside with a bunch of little boxes, primarily low-density residential. And so the development contains, in total, 668 acres of residential development, which amounts to approximately 4.1 units per acre within that residential development. Or if you look at the residential units for the whole site, it's closer to 1.9 units per acre. So it's a very low density project that they're proposing. It also includes 56 acres of commercial development, and they anticipate a population of 5,654 residents once the project's complete. So okay. it's a very large development they're proposing. They're claiming the project is mixed use. They use that word a few times in the draft EIR and their specific plan. But I really challenge that notion. I find that quite absurd, since the way the development is designed is the uses are segregated, heavily segregated. So you have the housing development sprawling up the hillside, then you have the commercial development completely separated closer to the valley. And so it's really not mixed use at all. It's primarily single family homes what's going to be constructed there.
Going back to the size and location, the whole site is a little under 1,500 acres, and some people have done mapping for it, and it is the size of some, around the size of some cities in the North Valley, including the city of Corning. It is bigger than the city of Corning, and from Beck's press release, we discussed how it's sparse housing stretching up ridgelines from Stilson Canyon to Honey Run Road. They call it Valley's Edge, but it's really in the foothills.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the commercial part of the development. Do you have any indication? I assume it's not big box stores. Is it boutiques, coffee shops? What kind of commercial development would go into a neighborhood like that?
Sure. So it's currently a little bit unclear. I would imagine the best case scenario would be coffee shops or restaurants that residents could potentially use. Sometimes maybe they could access it by bike or foot. But unfortunately, I find it highly unlikely that this kind of commercial development would actually be able to meet the needs of the residents of this proposed community. Mm-hmm. So it would really not preclude these residents from needing their automobiles to drive to and from the service centers within the city of Chico.
Right. No Home Depot, no Safeway in all probability.
Probably not.
Mm-hmm. And just for the location, it's around, what, 2.5 miles from Chico's urban core. So it would be really hard to get to without an automobile.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. So development projects in California that could conceivably have an adverse impact on the environment must go through the CEQA process. And I think probably people have heard the word CEQA, but what is CEQA and what is it intended to do?
So CEQA, or the California Environmental Quality Act, was a landmark piece of legislation, I'm pretty sure in the 1970s, 1975, that has given communities a voice in land use decisions, protect our state sensitive species and natural areas, and improve the livability of communities and keeping California healthy and safe. It gives community a voice in tools and land use decisions. It requires local government to be transparent around large development projects that may harm the environment, and pushes decision makers to adopt alternatives or mitigation to reduce adverse environmental impacts. And that's why we're all talking about this today.
Okay. And so the environmental impact report is done correspond with CEQA. It's a requirement of CEQA to have an environmental impact report. Is that correct?
Going back a little bit, I'm a little bit of a CEQA nerd. So it depends on what they find in usually an initial study. If they do find that there is a potential to have a significant impact on any of the, I think there's like 18 different topics they can analyze, then and if they can't mitigate it. If they can mitigate it, it would go down to an MND, which is a mitigated negative declaration. If they don't find anything, it would probably be an initial study and negative declaration. But if they find something and they find like a couple items or one topic or impact that they cannot avoid, it triggers the CEQA environmental impact report process, which is what we're going through now.
Okay. And what kinds of things does the environmental impact report look at? What does CEQA look at when it's deciding if they need an environmental impact? You've talked about the potential harm to the natural environment. What are some other things that they care about, that we care about?
Sure, yeah. So the EIR really looks at, like, the parameters of the project, resource overviews given the site and the local context. And so this includes things like aesthetics, cultural and tribal resources, greenhouse gases, water quality and drainage, noise, transportation, air quality, energy, hazards and hazardous materials, public services and recreation, wildfire, biological resources, geology and soils, hydrology, public utility, and yeah, so it includes these various aspects of the environment, and the EIR really includes an in-depth analysis of how the project relates to these various elements of the environment and how it might have the potential to negatively impact them. Mm-hmm. And As it does that analysis, and then when they find that there is the potential for a significant impact, then the EIR would then look at mitigations of what the developer can do to mitigate the impact to the environment below this threshold of significance.
And mitigations include avoiding the impact, minimizing the impact, rectifying the impact, and compensating the impact.
Could you say more about that, Maggie? You went really fast. So could you say a little bit more about that? Steve has something to say. Wait.
No, it's all right. I'm going to rant about mitigation in a minute, but go ahead.
Oh, no. We can rant.
Going through this environmental impact report for the Valley's Edge specific plan definitely has me think about inadequacies with how we do mitigation. But basically, for example, I did a deep dive into the air quality and biological resources. For air quality, they found significant impacts for reactive organic gases, nitrous oxide, and I'm pretty sure particulate matter 10. And so they just slapped together a handful of mitigations, including some measly energy conservation, as well as offsets and idling trucks and things like that. And so the mitigation that they believed that would be adequate is paying a company or a mitigation bank to reduce air quality somewhere else, maybe tree planting somewhere else. But it doesn't really get to the, if people have allergic reactions because there's too much reactive organic gases, they're still going to have to go to their urgent center. If they develop asthma, they're still going to be hospitalized. And so it's like, I see some issues with these mitigations that not just this project, but what CEQA allows in general.
Here's my rant on mitigation. It goes back to my time in Nevada when we were concerned about a proposal by the Las Vegas Water Authority to pipe water 300 miles from eastern Nevada to Las Vegas. And at the public hearings, there was a lot of talk about mitigation. Okay, we're going to put a telephone pole next to a place where we're going to dig a big hole, and that's next to a pond. We can mitigate that. And then we would go to the next little problem. And it was my considered opinion that the parts never added up to the whole. That is, you can mitigate in bits and pieces for a long time, but it never does restore the original, in that case, pristine nature of the project, of the area that was going to be impacted by the project.
Yeah, there's a lot to say about that, and we will continue to say them. What were the findings in the environmental...
I'm sorry, can I jump in one more? Who did the ERA? Who was paid to do it?
DUDEC.
Who is that? Are they specialists?
Yes, they are.
Are they paid, and are they neutral?
They are, they're meant to be neutral. It was created by DUDEC, and they're planners, scientists, and engineers. It's a national consulting company. They have offices all over the country, and I think their closest office here is Sacramento. Am I right about that, Maggie? You know all about that.
I don't know too much about the specific consulting firm. I've heard of DUDEC before. They seem pretty legit, but I'm pretty sure their closest office is Sacramento.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. What did this group find out when they wrote the environmental impact statement, or what did they report as the status of the Valley's Edge specific plan?
Yeah, so the EIR, they're the two findings that indicated significant and unavoidable impact were for greenhouse gas emissions, meaning that regardless of the mitigations that could be employed, this project will significantly contribute to climate change. And so they ultimately looked at and calculated the potential greenhouse gas emissions, what they expected it would be from construction as well as operation. And so for construction, they estimate construction of the whole project will emit 13,719 metric tons of CO2 equivalent. And they estimate once the project is operational, approximately 2045, the emissions of the project through operation will be 17,719 metric tons of CO2 equivalent, which is worth noting the year, 2045, which mm-hmm. when they expect to be operational. That's also the year that a California executive order and Chico's very own climate action plan calls for net zero emissions, which is zero metric tons of CO2 being emitted into the atmosphere. So that's the biggest impact that the EAR identifies. They also identify significant and unavoidable impacts to aesthetics from the degrading of the viewscape resulting from the development. And there's some impacts to air quality as well. And Maggie can talk about that.
Just to bounce off that climate action plan, we just approved and adopted the new climate action plan update that has goals for 2030 and a net zero emissions for 2045. And this plan will be obstructing our targets.
Go ahead. Finish.
I mean, we can pause. I'll be jumping into air quality.
I just want to ask one more question before you go to air quality. But what kinds of unmitigatable impacts would ordinarily swamp a project? Would ordinarily...
No pun intended.
Here's the thing. So going back, I probably should have described it a little bit more. So this is just transparency. A EIR can come out with all of these significant and unavoidable impacts, and it's political. It depends on our council.
Okay.
And so they can come out with biological resources is significant and unavoidable, air quality is significant and unavoidable, and housing and population is significant and unavoidable, and the council can do an overriding statement of these significant and unavoidable impacts and approve it. But that's why we're here. We're trying to community organize to try to get push our decision makers to stop and say, hey, this is not okay for our community. So it really depends community to community. Of course, there are some areas probably in the Bay Area or somewhere else that for these two impacts, it would be a done deal. But
We also really want to make sure that the EIR dotted their I's and crossed their T's, so to speak. So
yes.
The whole idea of the CEQA process is to engage the public in this process. And so that's what we're doing right now. It's the 45-day public comment period. So everyone out there has until December 13th to make written public comments to the city of Chico. And they also, everyone has the opportunity to make public comments to the Planning Commission on November 18th, the next Thursday, at the city council chambers.
Okay.
And so our kind of goal of looking over this EIR was to make sure that their analysis was thorough, that they really considered all of the factors at play when looking at the environment and really did their due diligence in determining whether they were significant. And as we'll get into later on, we believe that there are several instances where there was inadequate determination on the environmental impact, or that the mitigations were inadequate to actually reduce the impacts below that threshold. I'll keep going over what the EAR findings were. So there were potentially significant impacts to biological resources. This includes sensitive species, riparian habitat, adverse impact on protected wetlands. But after their mitigation, the EIR determined that all of these impacts were less than significant.
Right.
Same goes for other sections, including tribal and cultural resources, hazards and hazardous materials, noise, transportation and circulation, and wildfire. So on all of those sections, they determined that there was the potential for significant impacts, But if they do X, Y, and Z, these mitigations, the impacts will then not be no longer be significant. And so that's kind of up for debate. And that's where the public can come in, evaluate those, and provide feedback to the city in this EAR to ensure that they're correct in this.
Yes. Shall we just go on and not take a break?
Okay.
We'll just go on and not take a break. Let's talk about other concerns that environmental community has about the Valley's Edge development. The Butte Environmental Council and the Advocacy Committee specifically have been studying the draft environmental impact report and the description of the project and the Valley's, that's the Valley's Edge specific plan. The environmental impact report itself is over 700 pages long. Let's talk about some of the findings of the environmental impact statement and report and what your reaction to that is. We've talked a little bit about greenhouse gases. One of the things that, this is an enormous project. It's huge. There are, I can't remember the number of units of houses, but it's what? 2,777 units. And the anticipated population for the project is 5,654 residents. So it's enormous. As I can't remember, Maggie or Jared said that it's as big as some small towns. So let's talk a little bit more about what you see as some of the problems. And we talked about greenhouse gases a little bit. Just the idea, just the construction part is pretty overwhelming in terms of the greenhouse gases that are emitted. But then we're talking about the movement of 5,654 people from the foothills to town. There will not be a commercial center that can serve all of the needs of 5,654 people, even if they do, like, and these are small villages. They're not, you know, they're not a city out there. So there will be a huge impact of greenhouse gases just from the people needing to go get stuff or go places, go to the doctor or the dentist or whatever.
Why can't they take a bus?
We can talk about that.
Why don't we talk about
transportation?
One of the members on our committee has done some analysis and some research on effective transit and the proper density required for transit to really run at the time intervals that result in good ridership, that result in a lot of people taking transit. And I forget exactly, but I believe it's about 24 units per acre is typically what is needed for transit to be really effective, service coming every 15 minutes, therefore getting a lot of people able to get on the bus, on their schedule. But the density is just so low. It's so low. Yeah. As mentioned before, it's 4.1 units per acre just of the developed land. That's not including the 600-700 acres that will not be housing development. So as transit is probably, they're probably going to have some bus stops, but whether or not that's going to be effective, I find it very unlikely that transit would effectively serve residents of a development of this nature.
What we found is 14 units per acre are needed for like subsidized transit, and up to 22 would be non-subsidized transit that can make its own money and the like.
And we're far below that with this development.
So when you're talking about effective transportation, you mean wait time for transportation, the closeness of the stops to where people live. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about? What makes effective transportation?
Yeah, exactly. A bus stop within a reasonable walking distance of your home, a bus stop where the bus is going to come at frequent intervals, so you're not waiting an hour to hop on the bus to go to your destination. And so, one of the members in our committee, he analyzed that V-Line already has a poor and declining fare box recovery. meaning that it would be likely that a transit route extending to the Valley's Edge area, if built out to fulfill the plan, would require a much greater subsidy to operate than existing routes in more compact areas of Chico.
What does the EIR say about that? Does it say that that's a concern or a mitigatable impact?
I did not see that at all. What I saw was that transit was going to be a mitigation for VMT, a potential mitigation for greenhouse gas emissions. I know definitely for VMT. I'm not sure about the greenhouse gas emissions. I've been mentioning it. But they don't acknowledge that the density poses a problem to effective transit. I didn't read that anywhere, at least.
So this goes back to, like, the mitigation measures being inadequate. Like, I read the biological resources section, and for one of the mitigations for, I'm pretty sure, Western pond turtle was passive removal. And that is the mitigation for this. I'm pretty sure they're threatened, endangered, or sensitive species is just passive removal, which is, and if passive removal harms or harasses or threatens endangered species, it's prohibited under the Endangered Species Act. So I really think that some of these mitigation measures are wholly inadequate.
I'd like to say something about climate change before we jump off of that, because we were talking about that initially when they went into transit. I find it worth noting that the draft EIR, it acknowledges the climate change impact to Chico, including increases in average max temperatures up to 10 degrees hotter than we currently experience, extremely hot days expected to increase, drought extremes and wet extremes increase, more wildfire activity. But what I find the most shocking was that it acknowledges the two major contributors of climate change, which is CO2 emissions from fossil fuel use, as well as land use change. And I find it ironic that they don't, and appalling, that the EIR does not mention that the land use change they are proposing with the Valley's Edge specific plan would result in the greenhouse gas emissions they were talking about when they mentioned that as being a contributor of climate change. And that's not mentioned at all in these emissions calculations, is the greenhouse gas emissions that would occur as a result of grading this grassland, cutting down the oaks, and reducing the carbon storage in the soil and reducing the photosynthetic capacity of the landscape. There's no mention of that.
I just wanted to ask, what is passive about the removal of a turtle from the pond?
I have no idea. I have like a little table of all their mitigations. Burrowing owl is still like burrowing owl and the western pond turtle. The turtles will be relocated. The burrowing owls will have a passive relocation, and I'm pretty sure, bats have replacement of their roosting structure, which I think is like totally inappropriate and can harm these species.
This is George Orwellian. It sounds like active removal, not passive.
Yes.
The draft EIR also acknowledges that the Valley Foothill riparian woodland is considered a sensitive natural community. It's regulated as part of the stream zone under the Fish and Game Code. And in addition to the things that you just mentioned, Maggie, there are 38 species of nesting and migratory birds. And these include the western spadefoot, the loggerhead shrike, the yellow warbler. You can't do this kind of massive construction work and not disrupt or even collapse the habitat of these creatures. So and because it's so big, that collapse has a lot of implications for the earth.
Totally. And something that I find quite appalling about some of these mitigations for those species you mentioned and others is they mentioned before construction, if they find, for instance, a Swainson's hawk, what they'll do is they'll wait for, and if they find a nest with the Swainson's hawk, they'll wait for the juveniles to mature before they completely destroy their habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of not actively killing a baby Swainson's hawk, you're still removing their hunting grounds, their their nesting grounds. You're still removing their habitat. So I think the mitigation for things like that and just doing surveys to not actively kill them are inadequate because their habitat's still being reduced.
Right, right. We're talking with Maggie Sharpa and Jared Geiser about the proposed Valley's Edge project, which is being planned for the east of Bruce up in the foothills. It's called Valley's Edge, but as Maggie pointed out, this is a foothills project. It's not, I mean, it's beyond the edge of the valley. So let's take a short break now, and we'll come back and talk about some of the other problems that you see with the project.
This song goes a long way back. Goes back to 1970, to the first Earth Day. Sometimes I write songs, and songwriters write songs for special occasions and sing them once or twice, and then they just kind of fall by the wayside. But here, all these years later, I'm still singing this song simply because I still feel the need to sing this song. Did it have flowers? I've seen pictures of flowers, and I'd love to have smelled one. Whose river was this? Do you say it ran freely? Blue was its color. I've seen blue in some pictures, and you tell me you've been there. I tell me again. To know the forests had trees, the meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true? Whose gray sky was this? Oh, was it a blue one? Nights there were breezes, I've heard records of breezes, and you tell me you felt one. Whose forest was this, and why is it empty? You say there were bird songs and squirrels in the branches, and then why is it silent? Trees and meadows were green, the oceans were blue, and birds really flew. Can you swear that was true?
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and we're talking on the phone with Jared Geiser and Maggie Sharpa. They have been working on analyzing the environmental impact report for Valley's Edge, which is planned for east foothills in Chico. And we're talking about some of the problems that exist in the EIR, inadequate mitigations, and maybe most importantly, greenhouse gas emissions that cannot be mitigated at all, and this in the time of climate change. So what are some other things that you want to point out about this report?
Well, maybe the next would be housing and wildfires. This is in the wildland urban interface. In this space, fire is a reality. The site has been burned from wildfires, specifically campfire, and has a high likelihood of burning again. And from the EIR, there is fire damage from the campfire to the blue oak foothill pine woodlands within the site, and these the blue oak foothill pine woodlands will burn again most likely in the next 5 to 15 years, and CAL FIRE has identified this location is that as a fire hazard and is zoned moderate fire hazard area within the state responsibility area. And so I think two issues with this project are the type of housing as well as the location. Going back to the type, it's really important that our community or city, all of us are thinking about the type of housing that we need. And the state has designated our area to needing certain types of housing through the regional housing needs assessment. And in it, it went over types of housing that we need. We need very low income. We need low income. We need moderate housing. This type of housing would probably be most expensive because it's a lot of private roads and private infrastructure. And so one thing that I do want to bring up is, first of all, they didn't analyze housing and population, which they could have done in the EIR. But two, this is not the location where we need the housing, and this is not the like income of housing that we need.
Yes, definitely.
I wanted to ask a little bit about that. California has not grown for a number of years. 5 or 6 years, but we keep building more houses, projecting growth up through 2040. So is this flight from the big cities? Where would those 5,000 new residents come from? Is there anything in the, it's probably not in the EIR, but have the developers talked a little bit about what the market is?
Not really. That was one issue with the EIR as well as, so the EIR is for the Valley's Edge specific plan, which means that it's basically going to be a little mini general plan for this area. And one issue was there wasn't really a talk about market analysis and about what type of housing is needed and who is going to live in here. There is just speculation that the people living here will not be local Chico people. It will be coming retirees from the Bay Area, from Sacramento, LA, things like that. But this is all just speculative. But there was no real market analysis done.
There was an analysis done in the housing element update that looked at the type of housing that our community needs and looked at the kind they developed. And I don't have the numbers in front of me. But
I do. So we need very low income, RHNA allocation. We would need 974 for this. It's like a couple of years, and we have had 15 units produced. For low income, we need 643. We have done 9 produced. However, for above moderate income, we have done 166% above what we need. We needed 1,600 and we built 2,700.
So that just kind of shows what type of housing is being developed. And this development, the Valley's Edge specific plan, would be no exception and would indubitably be producing a lot of above moderate income housing, which our local documents are showing we have produced that need already.
And could you just also say what the first phase of the project is going to be, Jared?
I'm not sure exactly. I would imagine it would be the housing development.
I thought you knew. I wouldn't have asked you. The first one is the houses that are on the ridge. That's the equestrian.
Equestrian Ridge.
Equestrian Ridge. And these are houses that are by far the lowest density. They're on acres and acres of land. And these are millionaire houses. These are not houses for the people that are really needing housing right now. So that is supposed to be phase one. And
you need to keep your horse somewhere.
Okay.
It's also a completely different area. So it's area that would be accessible from Honey Run Road. So it's basically like Susan said, a millionaire little housing neighborhood separated from the rest of the development, access from Honey Run. So it really shouldn't be included in this plan at all or even considered as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree. I want to talk a little bit more. This is a wetlands piece of land. this is a wetland ecosystem, and all of the things that wetland creatures depend upon, and water crosses this seasonally, and Comanche Creek goes through this land. What do you think about how they're handling the hydrology of this project?
So I've been looking into this pretty extensively. I've spent probably, anywhere from 4 to 10 hours specifically looking at the impacts of wetlands, going over the geotechnical reports included in Appendix E, as well as the analysis in the biological resources section. And I'm very displeased with what was listed in the EIR regarding the wetlands. So the biggest wetland complex is located kind of in the northeast, directly adjacent to the bike path, proposed Stonegate development. And so kind of what we're looking at here is the largest areas of wetlands on the site, including vernal pools, vernal swales, wet meadows, seasonal swales. And what they're proposing is making that primary open space. So they want to make it open space around these wetlands. So then they can say in the EIR that they're not destroying the wetlands. And I commend not destroying wetlands, I am unhappy with the fact that all above the wetlands, this wetland preserve, will be a whole bunch of low-density residential housing, very low-density residential housing, and a little bit of medium-density residential housing. But nonetheless, for this preserve to be effective in protecting the wetlands, it can't disconnect the hydrologic connection between the wetlands and the land that drains into it. And I'm very afraid that it is going to be hydrologically disrupting the wetlands as a result of adding all of these impervious surfaces that are going to come from residential development, such as the roads, the houses themselves, and then the way they're going to be managing that runoff, the stormwater. So right now the runoff just runs to the lowest point and ultimately is running into these wetlands. But once you start to develop storm drains, they're going to be having stormwater retention basins and various ways of managing that runoff. And I'm afraid it's not going to be running into these wetlands. And another factor of this site that I noticed in the geotechnical report, Appendix E of the EIR, was that there are springs on this site, or what they're calling groundwater seepage areas, areas where when the groundwater levels are high enough, this water is seeping up out of the earth. And there is a seepage area uphill in the north drainage that appears, from my understanding of hydrology and my understanding of the site based on these maps and all of this, that this groundwater seepage area would be flowing into these wetlands. And they don't overlay the proposed impervious surface development with these other maps identifying the wetlands, identifying the seepage areas or the springs. So it looks like they're going to be impacting the springs with this development. And so that might also contribute to a reduction in the volume of water that would flow to these wetlands, thereby impacting it. And so the EIR kind of looks at the wetlands, and they acknowledge that complete wetland avoidance is not possible. And so I believe 1 acre of waters, which 1.25, which could include the creeks, but about 1 acre will be disturbed or developed over. So they're saving the majority of it. But nonetheless, California has lost 90% of its wetlands to date. So we already have destroyed, developed, drained so many of the wetlands native to the state that, as far as I'm concerned, at this point in time, we need to preserve every last wetland we have, and we need to not jeopardize the sustainability of the wetlands as a result of unsustainable housing development.
Yeah. Are there other things? Yes, I agree. Well, they're going to create a lake, and so they're going to be changing everything about the water that's there. You can't create a lake without and move water around and have it still sustain the life that is there right now. Are there other things that stand out for you in this that we need to touch on?
Sure. Well, just really quick to finish the thought on that, I really think there's an adequate analysis of how what they're doing to the land is going to be impacting this, impacting the hydrology. One thing to mention that they claim in the EIR that groundwater recharge will not be significantly impacted as a result of the relatively impermeable lahar flow underlying the site. And so lahar flows are ancient volcanic mud flows that more or less block water transmission. But there are cracks in that lahar flow that they have some documentation of and that they've observed. But my biggest concern is that it does not indicate where the lahar flows don't exist. So there could be significant groundwater recharge occurring where these lahar flows don't exist. And they acknowledge throughout that the lahar flows do not cover the entire site. There are areas where they are not present. But they kind of downplay that, it seems like, when analyzing the groundwater recharge potential.
And lastly, the oaks. There are so many issues with this project. There are 5,500 oaks. They will be destroying 20% of them, around 1,100 oaks. Well, their specific plan that talks about the development is greenwashing. They're talking about how they're going to plant this forest of oaks. Well, I bet it's just a mitigation measure because they're destroying oaks. And so these keystone species are really critical to our ecosystem. Some have found to help with groundwater recharge. They're a groundwater-dependent ecosystem, and they are so important for carbon sequestration and storage. And so there's a lot of things wrong with the destruction of that many oaks.
Yeah. One of my problems with the plan, with the housing development, is that it's inconsistent. It says that it... it meets 300 target points of the general plan, but really it's not consistent with the general plan that is calling for dense housing, infill, protecting the natural environment outside of the city, and this is just the opposite of that. This is a sprawl project. And they say because it's an opportunity site, special planning area, that eventually it was supposed to be built on, but this is not something that we need now. It also is in direct contradiction to the climate action plan. As Maggie pointed out earlier, we're trying to get to zero emissions by 2045, and this, again, will be... doing the opposite of that. In construction over the next 10 years, it will be have a huge negative impact on the climate, on CO2 emissions, on greenhouse gases. And the update of the housing element, which has not yet been approved by City Council, but it's gone through a very extensive process of development. It calls for... Its major call really is for more affordable housing, and that's just not going to be available through the Valley Edge specific plan. So,
how can concerned citizens get involved in the process? You have hearings coming up. Tell us how we can go on record.
Thanks for asking, Steve. There's a lot that citizens can do. I think the first thing that can be done is engage in a community workshop being hosted by the Butte Environmental Council this Thursday, November 11th at 4 p.m. It will be via Zoom, and you can find more about this going to Beck. I recommend going to the Beck Facebook page. We have an official event for it. You'll find all the information you need there. If you're not on Facebook, you can go to the Beck website. Probably find some information about it there.
Or Beck has an advocacy email now, advocate@becknet.org. You can email and I'll be able to send you the Zoom link.
And so this workshop will dive into the EIR a bit, similar to what we have tonight, but maybe go in a bit more depth. But the workshop will really be focusing on how people can engage in the CEQA process. We've mentioned already today, and I'll reiterate, that right now we're in the public comment period. So it's a 45-day period where the city is asking people to make comments on the Valley's Edge draft EIR and to give input on it. And so I would argue the best time to give that input would be November 18th. at 6 p.m. at the city council chambers, where they're having a public hearing about it. And we plan to submit extensive written comments documenting certain inadequacies we've identified. But I really do think that making these comments in person is so important to let these local leaders, in this case the Planning Commission, know your thoughts on this. Let the Planning Commission know that there are a lot of citizens that have concerns about this, and those concerns need to be addressed.
However, it is important to get it into the record.
Yes.
So it is important to send mike.sully@chicoca.gov comments in the workshop that Jared talked about. The main point is helping people create effective public comments, either oral or written, but will definitely hit home. It's super important to get it into the record, which means written to Mike Sully, but it is also important to go to that public hearing and speak for 3 minutes in an abbreviated public comment.
And you can also help by writing letters to the Chico ER and the Chico News and Review. Some people just don't know that this is going on, and so we need to raise consciousness about a project that will be very damaging to our community. All the power and money is on the side of the developers of Valley's Edge, so the community has a right and duty to weigh in on things that affect our community. We are about out of time. Thank you so much, Maggie Scarpa and Jared Geiser. Both are on the board of the Butte Environmental Council, and Maggie is chair of their advocacy committee. Please come or Zoom into the workshop. If you go to becknet.org, you can get more information. And Maggie, give the email one more time, please.
Advocate@becknet.org.
Thank you very much. And thank you both for the work that you're doing on this, for bringing it to people's awareness. We really appreciate your work.
Yep. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll hear Bobby Tryon, North State Give and Take. She'll be talking about hospice and palliative care with Megan Anderson. She's the community educator for Butte Home Health, and also Sandy Galka, a registered nurse coordinator for Enlo Palliative Care. And we want to remind you that on Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. on the Ask Dr. Gail show, Gail will be talking to Ashanti Branch, founder of the Ever Forward Club, which provides help for African American and Latino males to reach their full potential and graduate from high school.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. You can go to our website for lots of other stuff, ecotopiakzfr.com. Thanks for listening.
You are the new day. Running out for everyone.
like a breath I knew would come, I reach for a new day. Home is my philosophy, just needs days in which to be.
You're tuned to 90.1 FM KZFR Chico. Up next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers, located in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923 and by the Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in the Chico area since 1980. The Printed Image is open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and by appointment. More information by calling 530-898-9525.